Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
The Tennis Podcast.
The Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. My name is David Law. I'm joined by Catherine Whittaker on this show, which is brought to you in association with The Telegraph. Catherine is back from Paris. The French Open is still very much going on, and it is at the business end because Andy Murray's into the final for the first time in his career. He's the first British man to do so since Bunny Austin in 1937. No man from Great Britain has won this event since 1935 and Fred Perry. But he has the ultimate challenge to come through if he's to win it. He's got to face Novak Djokovic, who's trying to win his first ever French Open title to complete the career Grand Slam. We've got Serena Williams trying to join Steffi Graf on 22 Grand Slam titles. She's up against Garbiñe Muguruza, who I think Catherine and I have been feeling that is the heir to Serena's throne for a while now. And what we do know is we are in for a seriously emotional weekend. Catherine, you're back from Paris and you've been finally greeted with some tennis, thankfully, after a soggy few days. And it doesn't really get much better than this, does it, as a prospect?
Tennis-wise, no. I mean, a few of the factors you mentioned there are detractors from what's going on. You know, the rain and the thoroughly miserable conditions. I mean, it sounded like it was about 10 degrees in Paris today, which is what it was in London as well. And it is pretty miserable. You know, the condition, the fact that Paris is going through a difficult time at the moment, you know, the floods are really, really serious. I feel for them. And that's obviously impacting on the crowds, which, you know, broke my heart a little bit to see how empty the stadium was for how empty Félix Chatrier was to see for Serena walking on court today, well, Serena and Kiki Bertens. But, you know, there are still going to be two singles champions at the end of the week, and those two titles will still be as important and significant to them and to the tennis world as any other Grand Slam title in history, possibly more so full stop, because it would be Muguruza's first, it would be Serena's record equaling 22nd, it would be Andy Murray's incredible first clay court Grand Slam, and it would be Novak Djokovic completing the career Grand Slam. So actually, you know, it is tennis-wise, matches-wise, it is all there and it's all brilliant. It's just there are these other factors going on which you can't ignore that are, I mean, in some ways making it more interesting, but in other ways detracting from it a little, I suppose.
You're right. It's been heartbreaking, actually, the last couple of days to see. I must admit, not having been in Paris, I wasn't aware of quite how serious these floods are. I saw some of the photos today, some of our colleagues, Stuart Fraser, one or two other people, taking photos of the streets of Paris, places that are normally inhabited by people walking along, jogging along rivers, driving along, and yet these roads and streets are just not passable because of the sheer
They're not visible, David.
The
They're not visible.
No.
I mean, my journey to the Gare du Nord yesterday took an hour and a half because of how many roads were closed due to flooding. It's really, really serious, and more rain is forecast. I mean, it did rain torrentially and relentlessly for about 2.5 days in Paris. It really was like the apocalypse. So I'm not surprised they're experiencing some issues. And I just hope, I mean, I hope full stop that Paris is okay, flooding wise. But I in particular hope it can be okay until the end of Sunday and we can get the tennis played.
Yeah, we can get a little bit precious in our tennis bubble, can't we, at times? I think we all huddle together and talk about how this is going wrong and that day was 2 hours and 1 minute and no refunds were given and start complaining about this, that and the other. And the sheer fact is that there's a lot more important things in life than just the tennis. And, of course, Paris in particular has gone through a pretty torrid time of late. One thinks of the terrorist atrocities late last year as well. And it's been just a miserable time for the city in that regard. And those measures allied to the extra security that's obviously been in place at Roland Garros, they've also got the issue. I mean, it's a better news issue that obviously Euro 2016 is about to start, the football as well. So perhaps that's taken people's attentions away in terms of saving up to go and see a sporting event. And it has led to these really depleted crowds.
What I want to know is, are the tickets sold out and people not showing up? In which case, you know, that's one issue, and I'm sure the flooding is having an impact. Or are the tickets not sold? That, I mean, well, as far as I don't have that information, I can't find that information.
The gist of what I heard today is that they were selling, certainly on Philippe Chatrier, and people weren't coming. But I'm not 100% sure, certainly on Suzanne Longlong, where they had to play the extra matches simultaneously today, which will make our discussion of the semi-finals a little tricky on one count, because I know my attention was concentrated throughout the day on Philippe Chatrier, which meant that I missed the Muguruza-Stosa match to a large degree. Same with Djokovic against Thiem. Those matches all had to be played at the same time just to get this thing finished on time. And it has been a logistical nightmare for the organisers. I really feel for them in that regard. Plus, for the players, I mean, this is a real test. The players that have come through here have really shown yet again what they're made of. Because if you think about Murray with his two back-to-back five-setters in the first two rounds, okay, you could say that's of his own making. Novak Djokovic having to come through that, what was it, three-day match against Bautista Agut. We've got Serena Williams playing four matches in 4 days in order to try to win this tournament. And Muguruza will have had a similar story. This is a really testing, trying period of time for these players, and they've come through with flying colours.
Yeah, word on the organisers. I mean, they really, really, there have been some sad-looking faces behind the scenes. I've really felt for them. You know, I know they haven't necessarily made every decision perfectly in the way that people have wanted to, but I think, you know, they've been trying to do their best. Poor old Guy Forget in his first year in the job. Thank goodness he's as good a public face as he is, because they've been holding impromptu Guy Forget press conferences pretty much every day for the last week, and he's very, very good at them. They did do so, I think, in very difficult circumstances. They were actually able to create quite a positive today, which was that obviously they weren't expecting to have two semi-finals on Longlen today, and they made the tickets for that available at €20, and they gave priority to those that had tickets for Philippe Chatrier the other day, who saw 2 hours and 1 minute of play, the cutoff being 2 hours to receive any kind of refund, and they didn't receive that refund because of that one precious minute that took them over the threshold. But those people, those understandably quite angry people from the other day, it was the day that they saw the first set in a bit, well, first set, I think, actually, of Roberto Bautista Agut, and the resumption of the women's match before it. They received priority for tickets on Longlen today, and I think that was a very, very wise and smart move from them. So yeah, it's been a really tough time for them, tough time for the players. I mean, I suppose for the women, you could say, I mean, they were being asked about it a lot, and they just said, well, we do this every week of the year. We play back-to-back three-set matches, and I suppose, you know, this leads us into, you know, my point. I do think women should be playing five sets at some stage of Grand Slams, and, you know, it sort of highlights the point, I suppose, that actually, it isn't any more of a physical test at Grand Slam level for women than it is for men. In on one side of the coin, it's less of a test, because in normal circumstances, they do get a day off between matches. They're not getting that now. but that's because of these extraordinary circumstances. So anyway, but that, as we know, is a very different and very time-consuming debate, which we won't get onto now.
Well, actually, just on quickly on it, though, Catherine, because I am going to get into it. The one thing for me about it as well, take the equality element aside, when you get to a big final like this, Muguruza against Serena Williams, what I don't want is somebody to just come out cold and nervous and not have time to get settled out there. I realise that is part of the occasion, is trying to settle quickly and so forth, but best of five gives a player time to gather themselves and just get comfortable in the surroundings. I'm thinking of Muguruza, obviously, not Serena Williams, who's won so many. And I think you would you safeguard yourself then against the blowout final that actually isn't very good. But anyway, as you said, that's another point. In terms of the routes to this women's final, which will take place on Saturday, Serena Williams has been serene for the most part, and then the last couple of rounds have been really testing. I mean, Kiki Bertens came in today. It was fascinating seeing a player who'd apparently got a calf injury, and you could see that she couldn't run. She just decided, I'm not going to run to certain balls. And Serena Williams had cottoned on to the injury. She was drop-shotting way more than she normally would. We've now learned, thanks to the detective work of Marion Bartoli, that there is an injury concern for Serena Williams. In fact, Serena, I think, took 2 hours to come to her press conference last night because she was having treatment.
And so, do you know how long it lasted once she got there, David?
How long?
3 minutes. Three minutes.
Okay.
Everyone waited for 2 hours for a 3-minute press conference.
I bet they were a good 3 minutes, though, weren't they? Anyway, Serena Williams, as quick on the court as she is off the court, as you could see. But she doesn't look overly inhibited on the court, certainly. I don't think she wanted to reveal that information, so that could be an interesting conversation with Marion Bartoli, but, you know, fair enough to Bartoli, she works in the media now. But it's going to be interesting, isn't it, that final against a player who is one of the few that doesn't seem to be intimidated.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I am loving those post-match on-court interviews between Marion Bartoli and Serena Williams. There is more than a touch of awkwardness. And I think Marion Bartoli actually deals with it very well, because that's a tough gig, I think. They're certainly entertaining.
Well, I've commentated with Marion, and she doesn't really give a two hoots about who she's talking to. She's just herself. She's quite happy and confident enough to be herself.
But I'm sure she'll be aware of the slight hint of awkwardness. I mean, you'd be mad not to. But anyway, it provides her entertaining viewing for us, so it's absolutely fine by me. I don't think Serena's seemed... I mean, everybody said her progress has been serene, but I don't think she seemed particularly serene behind the scenes. I mean, I don't know. There's been, after a few of her press conferences, there's been some murmuring from journalists about possibly, you know, she's whether a cold or just something, whether she's perhaps been suffering from hay fever. A lot of people have been over the past fortnight. The pollen count was particularly high, even for this time of year in Paris. And I've no idea if Serena is a hay fever sufferer, but certainly there were some signs that she was a bit bunged up or sniffly or just, you know, something not quite right. And certainly we saw symptoms of that against Yulia Putintseva. I mean, that was quite an emotional roller coaster, wasn't it? It was one of those ones where, you know, once she got her comeback on track, she was doing that fist pump where she crouches over and she just seems to, you know, her whole face contorts. She was doing that whole body fist pump where her knee goes up and her fist goes up and her face contorts, and it's all consuming after every single point that she won. And that for me is an indicator that she's battling through something.
But that might be stress, Catherine, because I was listening today, I was watching Eurosport and Chris Evert was in commentary, and she was saying nobody realises just the stress that you go through when you're being shot at all the time, when you're the one expected to win because you're the top seed and they're all gunning for you. And she was saying that she reckons Serena finds that difficult. And if you look at the last couple of slams, that would appear to add up.
Absolutely. And then that brings us back to what Simon Briggs and I were discussing in our last podcast a few days ago about how related, you know, the physical and the mental are. You know, stress-related injuries or stress-caused injuries are a very, very real thing. And they and the symptoms are exactly the same. It's just the causes are, you know, slightly more unfathomable, or certainly unfathomable for us as mere bystanders and non-scientific professionals. So I'm absolutely sure all of that goes into it. I mean, we cannot imagine those circumstances. We just can't imagine. And, you know, I know I joke about a 3-minute press conference, but from what I understand, it wasn't 3 minutes because, you know, she walked out or refused to answer questions. It was just, she answered the questions that were given to her. She revealed what she wanted to and kept the rest to herself, which is entirely her prerogative, as frustrating as it is for journalists. And that was that. There was nothing more to be said. And she's, you know, it's self-preservation, isn't it? She is going for history. She's going to break the record. And, you know, given what happened in Australia, when it seemed to be, you know, destined, not to mention what happened in New York, you can understand her completely wanting to shield herself from anything that might interfere with that. So, you know, of course stress is a factor, of course it is. I just don't think we can fathom the ways and the specifics of that, because it's just so far from anything we'll have ever experienced.
Yeah, and I think in her opponent as well, we have somebody that is a bit of an unknown in terms of sheer physical stature and ability and weapons. We have somebody who can stand nearly toe-to-toe with Serena Williams. I don't think anybody can when she's really absolutely firing, particularly the serve can just take the racket out of the hand. But Muguruza is a player who's had mini roller coasters over the last couple of years. When she's been absolutely on her game, she's not far off unplayable herself. She's had some difficult periods, only short ones, I would say. Always highlighted, I think, by the fact that they have the on-court coaching at the WTA events, and we actually get to hear her conversations with her coach, Sam Sumic, which have sometimes been rather animated, and she's given him a pretty hard time. But she, I think she's a joy to have her on the tennis circuit, a really good news story for women's tennis and for tennis in general. And I just wondered, though, do you feel that there is anything that you've seen? I mean, you went for Simona Halep to reach the final. Everybody hear that? I obviously went for Garbiñe Muguruza. Have you seen anything, though, Catherine, that makes you think that Serena Williams won't win this final?
Oh, I think there's quite a significant chance that she won't win the final. She's going to have to play so much better than she has done for the last couple of rounds, and probably better than she has done at any stage during the tournament, I think. I think she's the favourite, but not by a mile, not by much, actually. I think Muguruza has a real chance. You know, on the subject of self-preservation, by the way, Muguruza's a really interesting one. I agree with you that she's good for tennis. I think she's a really nice girl, really nice woman. But she has changed remarkably over the past 2 years in terms of how she presents herself to the press, I suppose. I remember I did her press conference after she beat Serena at the French Open 2 years ago, and that was her announcement onto the tennis stage. It was an extraordinary day, that day, 2014, I think, the second round. She beat her completely comprehensively, 2-2, I think. And it was quite something. And she came in and she was this bubbly, completely open girl. It was almost like verbal diarrhea. You know, any question that she was asked, you know, she just laid herself completely on the line, and every thought that was in her head tumbled out. And she's completely the opposite of that now. She's still warm and nice and friendly and perfectly personable, but she doesn't reveal a thing in press conferences. You know, she's Maria Sharapova in that respect, who gives nothing away. You know, it's this wall between her and the world. And again, as frustrating that is for journalists, it does seem to be a trait that champions have. They, you know, it's something that maybe you learn to develop if you really are ambitious and intent on succeeding, and she seems to have it. So I think she will win Grand Slams. I think she could win this one. As I say, Serena's the favourite, but not by much in my book.
And it is, blimey, pretty split. I'm just looking at the poll that I've run, obviously, at Tennis Podcast on Twitter. And we have a pretty split vote here. My goodness. In fact, we have 52% of the vote going for Muguruza. So 48 going for Serena, 52 for Muguruza, and the majority think Muguruza, 39% of all votes, that Muguruza will win in three sets. I mean, there's a strong representation for all four potential outcomes. And, you know, I think that it is that kind of final, isn't it? If you think of their head-to-head, all of their matches, all four matches have been at Grand Slam tournaments. They've never played anywhere else. And so they've been on the big stages. It's 3-1 to Serena Williams, but Muguruza has won their one match at Roland Garros, and she won it 6-2, 6-2 a couple of years ago in the second round. We have that Wimbledon final to think about last year that was pretty competitive, and Serena won that in three sets. So, I mean, if they both play to the best, we're going to have a really good final.
Absolutely. I think I mean, this is a completely redundant thing to say, I suppose, but if they both play to their best, Serena Williams wins, because her best is still the best. But I think the peak tennis that each of them have played throughout the tournament, I think Muguruza's has been better. I don't think Serena Williams has reached her peak, but then she hasn't had to. You know, she's had to fight against Putintseva, but she still didn't have to produce her very best tennis to win that. She just had to sort of dig deep emotionally, I think. So it's going to be really interesting. I mean, I wouldn't put Muguruza as the marginal favourite, but I do agree with how close that polling has come. Because, you know, I think it is close, and I just desperately hope that it's a really, really competitive final. I mean, we can only dream of it being as good as the Australian Open final. But if it comes close, then that'll be just great.
One thing, turning the attention to the men's final now, Catherine, that you mentioned if both players play at their best, Serena Williams wins. A point made by Mats Wilander on Eurosport today was that Stan Wawrinka's best tennis is probably going to beat anybody. But the yep. point he also made is that Andy Murray has the ability to stop you playing your best tennis. And I think we saw that to a tee in the quarterfinals when he played against a really firing Richard Gasquet, and he just kept on throwing drop shot after drop shot in his direction. And I think most of us who've spent more than a decade watching Andy Murray hit drop shots and wondering whether it's the right thing to be doing, we're getting maybe frustrated if they were observing this, because they're wondering, is it a good tactic or not? But it felt to me, as the match wore on, that this isn't just about trying to win points. This is about trying to turn the tide of a match overall, the long game, wear him out. And I don't think you can do that as much against Wawrinka physically, because he's a warrior of a man. But I do think he got in Wawrinka's head, because Wawrinka came out and played one of the best games of tennis in the first game of the match that I've ever seen. I've seen Sampras once play a game like that, where he just hit four perfect winners, all different types. I've seen Federer do it, obviously, a number of times. But this was Wawrinka, peak Wawrinka for a game. And he won that first game to love. He came on strong in the second, and Murray just held on. But the variety that sometimes can be Andy Murray's undoing the last couple of rounds have been the making of him getting to this final. Obviously, he's in great form. He's hitting the ball incredibly hard. He's not afraid to mix it and stand toe-to-toe with Stan Wawrinka, and he was coming out on top. But the variety, generally speaking, was just bamboozling the guy.
Yeah, I mean, the Andy Murray drop shot is a very interesting talking point, because, yes, there are some matches where he employs it to perfection. He seems like a drop shot genius some matches. And then what happens is he thinks, oh, great, you know, this drop shot's really working for me. And then he goes into a match where it's not the appropriate tactic, and he's drop shotting left, right and centre, and he gets a bit self-indulgent with the drop shot. I think he's almost sort of goading himself into, you know, is this going to be a drop shot day? So, I mean, yes, sometimes it can seem like a genius thing to do, and they're all coming off, and there is no more sort of beguiling shot in tennis really is there. Maybe the lob, but I mean, when you hit a perfect drop shot and it comes off, you know, perfect idea, perfect execution, you just look like a master tennis player, don't you? So, yeah, I mean, in the past few rounds, it has looked like an enormous weapon for Andy Murray. It's less of a weapon against Djokovic. I think he'll need to be a lot more sparing with it. I don't think he can charge into that match thinking, right, well, the drop shot's got me in through the last two matches, so... yeah, the drop shot's going to get me through this one. I'm sure he won't, you know. I'm sure he won't, but not against Novak Djokovic, not in a final. But I think he has perhaps been guilty of that before. But yeah, it's been tactically really astute from Andy Murray. I mean, that Gasquet match, it all felt so predictable to me. I know that's harsh on Richard Gasquet. He played some wonderful tennis for two sets. It was the most magnificent tennis match. But you just knew at every stage of that second set... You just knew, well, I felt like I just knew, Murray's going to just win this and then it's going to be two very, very one-sided sets afterwards. I mean, maybe others felt differently, but I felt like the writing was on the wall, yeah, pretty much from the start. That whole match followed exactly the pattern that you'd probably have expected from it. I mean, today's one against Wawrinka... I didn't predict that Murray would play that well, actually. I can't really think of a time when I've ever disagreed with Mats, but I think that's really, really astute analysis. And I think there's, after big matches, you know, there's too much, oh, well, so-and-so didn't play their best. Well, how often do you play your best and lose? You know, half of losing is not being allowed to play your best. It's not in your control whether or not you play your best tennis. Sometimes it is, but a lot of the time it isn't. And it certainly wasn't in Stan's control today. I mean, the conditions, Pat Cash was very interesting on BBC Five Live Sports Extra during the commentary today. You know, he sat down, he said he had actually hit on Philippe Chatrier this morning. It was the only court available for him to warm up for his seniors match. They told him there's nowhere available to hit. And he said, what about Chatrier? That's free. And they said, all right, yeah, fill your boots. So off they went to warm up for their Legends match on Chatrier. And obviously Pat Cash has played on there many times before, probably every other year. And he said he was blown away by how slow the conditions were. He was really startled by it. And, you know, yeah, that's not ideal for Murray, but I'm quite sure that Wawrinka would have really, really hated those conditions. So, but then again, Murray capitalised on that. He played a really smart match for the conditions, for the
circumstances. Why would Wawrinka not have liked those conditions? Because the theory that I've been hearing was that he was a player who could hit through those conditions.
Yeah, but not when Andy Murray's giving you... drop shots and slices, and he wants some pop off the ball. He wants hitting through when you've got as good a retriever on the other side of the net as Andy Murray. If you're trying to hit through, but the ball's sitting up nicely for one of the best defenders in the world to get to the ball and get back in the rally, that's no good to you, is it? So, and Andy Murray was just getting to everything. You know, there were a couple of retrievals, you know, where he hit winners off balls where he was. You felt like he was just lucky to get there in the first place, let alone hit a winner off them. And you can just imagine Stan must have thought, what on earth have I got to do?
Well, there was a great line from Mats when it was two sets to love and Wawrinka was a breakdown as well in the third at that time. And Wawrinka actually applauded Andy Murray. And Verlander said, if you applaud your opponent when you're two sets to love and a breakdown...
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. You know that the player means it because you know, he's desperately disappointed with how things are going, and yet he's still able to acknowledge the brilliance of his opponent. Now, of course, we were unable, because we were concentrating on that match, to properly follow Djokovic against Thiem, which was going on the Suzanne Long court. I thought it would be closer than what it ended up being. I think it shows how clever Djokovic is as a match player, that these young players, these new players on the block, they find it very difficult to do to him in any way what they've been doing to everybody else. Maybe Thiem perhaps got a little bit startled in the circumstance of being in his first Grand Slam semi-final as well. And also, he's obviously played a heck of a lot of tennis, as we talked about in our preview edition. But once again, Djokovic has come through a pretty tricky week. And I reckon he took an almighty telling off from Boris Becker and Marion Vida when he was a set down to Roberto Bautista-Agut, and looking for an excuse, it seemed to me, at that stage. He looked as though he was feeling as though the world is against him, that, for instance, Murray had already gone through to the quarters, and here he was having to play this match over 3 days. I think he went off the court at the rain break and probably got a right old telling off and told to just lighten up, because that's when he came out with the umbrella, that's when he came out with a smile on his face and just seemed to make light of the situation, and it made him a better player.
Yeah, absolutely. He was in trouble there against Roberto Bautista-Agut, and it was notable that he was... I mean, I suppose all of the people that ended up winning those matches were less critical of the fact that they were made to play on that ridiculously miserable, soggy, damp day where they got about 2 hours of play all in all. But he did hold back from being overly critical, because actually I think it saved him, them coming off for the rain at that particular moment. I think that decision really, really did save his bacon a bit. And I suppose he could have, you know, picked fault with being made to play in the first place, and he did a little bit. He said it was right on the borderline, whereas Radvanska and Simona Halep said it was completely unsafe, rah rah rah. You know, you've got to take into account that they'd just come off the back of very, very disappointing losses. I'm not saying they didn't have a point, but you know, that I'm sure that was a factor. Djokovic said it was right on the cusp of safe and playable. But yeah, I don't think he can have too many complaints, because he was lucky. I'm quite sure, you know, who was it in commentary I was listening to the other day? I've heard so many commentators over the past few days saying, I think it was actually Mike Dixon again on 5 Live Sports Extra, saying he's a bit sceptical of the value that is placed on coaches and support teams. He thinks that it's over-egged a bit and rather exaggerated in the modern game. But when one time, and it's not exaggerated, when they really do earn their money is during rain delays. And I think he's absolutely right in saying that. I mean, how many times in history can you say that, you know, a rain delay has completely interrupted the momentum of a match? You know, even Richard Gasquet against Kei Nishikori, he was down in that first set. Rain came back on, never looked back from there, accelerated towards the finish line. So, yeah, Djokovic had a little slice of luck. I'm not saying in other circumstances he wouldn't have come through that, but you're right, he was looking for excuses. He was, you know, he wasn't his usual composed self. He hasn't, to be fair. I like you, didn't see the match against Team today. By all accounts, it was pretty plain sailing and there was no need for him to get frayed around the edges at all. But we certainly have seen him frayed around the edges in the past few days. And yesterday, he was actually extremely lucky not to get defaulted, by all accounts. Yes, there was no intent there with the racket throw, or as far as we know, we've got no reason to think there was intent there at all. But, you know, speak to Tim Henman about whether intent is required or not, because he famously got defaulted from Wimbledon for hitting a ball girl with the ball. Again, no intent, but it happened. And, yeah, he was a whisker away from being defaulted from the French Open at the quarterfinal stage, which is an extraordinary thing, really.
Yeah, it was. I do think it was completely accidental, having seen the video footage. But you are quite right. I mean, I think it was accidental when David Nalbandian kicked a line judge's box that was in front of him. I don't think he intended to hurt the guy, but he did hurt the guy. He ended up getting defaulted. And frankly, as you quite rightly say, when the racket slipped out of Djokovic's hand, if it had hit the line judge, I'm afraid there's no decision to make other than to disqualify him. At least that's how it would seem to me. I think Djokovic realised that as well.
It's fault by negligence, isn't it? It's complete lack of consideration for anything or anyone else around you. And I suppose, you know, reckless decision-making in the heat of the moment can be, if not excused, it can be explained. But, you know, it's all signs that, like we were talking about with Serena, this is stressful for Djokovic. There is no doubt this is stressful. With every round that goes by, he wants it more. It feels more possible, you know, and you can imagine him thinking, if not now, then when? And the pressure that must place on him, you know, never mind the pressure that external forces are placing on him. He must be thinking, if not now, when? And then all the other thoughts he'll be having, well, you know, I always beat Murray in Grand Slam finals recently, but then, you know, Murray beat me in Rome. And all of these thoughts are churning in him. And the stress is very, very visible.
The stress is very, very visible. Now, ahead of the Australian Open final between Murray and Djokovic, we were all wondering how Murray was going to find a way past Djokovic back then. You'll remember that Djokovic eventually won it in four sets. But before that final, we did speak to some of the greats of the game. There was Mats Wilander, Mark Philippoussis and Thomas Johansson. Let's hear from them all.
I think that Andy has to mix it up. He cannot try to beat Novak in his best game. He really has to try to play with a lot of variation. He has to be very aggressive on his second serve. And maybe try to, you know, come to the net once in a while.
So who wins and how many?
My prediction is Novak in four.
Andy has a chance, but I believe in order for him to beat him, he needs to get out of his comfort zone. It's important for him to take risks. It's two guys that move just as well as each other, two incredible counterpunchers, but unfortunately he's come across only one more person who's a better counterpuncher than him, and that's Djokovic. You know, And right now is in another level. To play out of your comfort zone and be aggressive, best out of five sets, is incredibly tough against him. Guys have beaten him best out of three. Best out of five is incredibly tough. One guy he lost to was Wawrinka. And that's because Wawrinka, no matter what the score was, he always went for his shots. Even when he was missing, he kept on going for his shots. And I think that was a difference. Murray, I know that's not his game. I know he hits from the baseline. He loves being on the run. He loves being defensive against Djokovic. That can't work. Not in best of five sets. Maybe in a best of three. Not in a best of five. So for him to have a chance, unless it's going to be, if he doesn't do this, it's going to be four sets for Djokovic. But he needs to get out of his comfort zone. He needs to mix it up by coming to net a little bit, sneaking in the net, because he's improved his volleys, and take chances. That's what I believe has to happen.
And if he does that?
He has a chance of winning. Yes,
I think the right way is a little bit of dead balling down the middle, a la Gilles Simon. I think some of it's a little bit of Roger Federer, which is taking Djokovic's second serve, especially with his own backhand, Andy, and make sure that Novak knows he can't hit short serves to my backhand. I think that he needs to throw in a few slice backhands, keep the ball low to Novak's backhand mainly, but also out, sort of an inside out to Novak's forehand. Hope that Novak puts it up high in the middle of the court and then attack the next one. You're going to have to do a bit of running once you do that, but I do believe that he needs to throw in, you know, one or two serve and volley points just to keep Novak on guard, and it's a very, very complicated puzzle that he has to put together, and you have to be emotionally and mentally ready to make decisions that are necessarily not going to make you win the points, but it's going to set the tone for the match, and you can go back to that play once you get tired or once it's a big point. And I mean, he's going to have to put together a masterpiece tactically, that's for sure. But Andy Murray has every single shot in the book to do that. And I think that we still haven't really seen the best of Andy Murray in that way. He did it in Wimbledon. He did it at the US Open when he beat Novak. I think Novak wasn't as good then as he is now. So it's going to be tricky, but it needs to be fun, because that's a fun match to play.
So, Catherine, that was back a few months ago, ahead of the Australian Open final. Do those arguments that all of those gentlemen have made there still apply in terms of this being the ultimate challenge for any tennis player and the strategy that Andy Murray needs to try to employ in order to come through? Do you think we're in the same situation, just Groundhog Day, as we were 4 or 5 months ago?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, I think some and many of the things still applying. At the end of the day, they still have the same games, and the dynamic between them, therefore, to an extent, remains the same. But I do see this really, really differently. For a start, Andy Murray doesn't have a baby imminently on the way. We don't know how big a factor that was in the Australian Open, but I think that, combined with what happened to Nigel Sears, I think possibly the latter actually affected him even more so than the former. It certainly did play a part in that Australian Open final. I think the Rome final is significant. I think it's particularly significant for Andy Murray. I think Djokovic can probably discount it and go, whatever, best of three sets. Generally speaking, I've got the better of this guy. But for Andy Murray mentally, it's really important for me. I think you can see how, not this is necessarily a factor in the final, but the pride that Andy Murray feels in this achievement. I don't think he feels any pressure to win this one. I think he knows and feels that this is an immense achievement that he's managed to make the final here. He started his career, even when he started winning Grand Slams and contending at Grand Slams, I don't think this really felt like a real achievable thing for him to even reach a French Open final. He's had to work incredibly hard at something that doesn't necessarily come naturally in order to get here. And I think he feels an immense amount of pride in that he's reached all four Grand Slam finals now. That's something that Pete Sampras didn't do. Remember, Pete Sampras, the great Pete Sampras, he couldn't reach a French Open final. It's really something, and I think Murray feels that it's really something. He's really proud of himself, and I don't think he's going to put the same pressure on himself that he would going into, you know, what turned out to be, you know, the umpteenth consecutive Australian Open final defeat to Novak Djokovic. You know, that was gutting. You know, I think he probably went into that one, as Djokovic might be going into this one, thinking, oh God, if not now, then when? Am I ever actually going to win an Australian Open final against Novak Djokovic? So I think the dynamics are a bit different. Look, Djokovic is the favourite. Of course he's the favourite. But I think there's an awful lot of other things going on with this one that weren't going on in Australia. The stress of Djokovic, that Rome final, the pressure being slightly different, the conditions significantly. I don't know who the crowd are going to favour. Djokovic is quite popular in Paris, possibly more so than elsewhere. You know, remembering the ovation that he received after he lost the final last year, that was very warm indeed. I don't know whose side the crowd will be on. Historically, the French aren't massive fans of the British, but but maybe they've warmed to us. I don't know. So I mean, look, it's not a completely different kettle of fish. It's the same two tennis players stepping out on the court. They've got the same forehands, backhands and serves. But for me, there are some significantly different dynamics going on there.
Yeah, I thought that was a good stat on Pete Sampras. I forgot that. And you're right. I mean, if you think of the history of the game, just highlights again what these four players in particular have done over the last decade. I mean, Andy Murray is effectively the poor relation, given what Federer, Nadal and Djokovic have put on the table in terms of Grand Slam titles won. He's only won two and they're all in double figures. But in terms of the number of Grand Slam semis and finals he's reached, and now to have reached the final of all four, it's a massive achievement. And it's Maria Sharapova-like, isn't it, in terms of his way of getting used to the surface and becoming so effective on it. Incidentally, Brad Gilbert today making a very big point on Twitter that he feels, and he has felt for a while all this year, that clay is now Andy Murray's best surface. Mats Wilander was suggesting that a little bit today. We've had John McEnroe talking about how he feels this is the best chance Andy Murray would ever have to win the French Open. That was a couple of rounds ago when he was facing Richard Gasquet. And certainly, I mean, look, he's still got to play the ultimate challenge in tennis. He's got Novak Djokovic. This guy is head and shoulders the world number one. But we are in unknown territory for both players here. Neither of them knows what it is like to win the French Open. And that makes this all the more intriguing because we don't know who it's going to affect the most. And well, I just can't wait. It's going to be absolutely cracking, isn't it? Let's just check on what everybody thinks is going to happen. We ran a poll, of course we did, at Tennis Podcast to find out what everybody thinks.
We're going to hear it through the airwaves. I'm rolling my eyes.
Yeah, we can kind of feel that. We don't even have to hear it. We've got 352 votes over the last few minutes, and we have a 59%. In favour of Andy Murray and 41% in favour of Novak Djokovic. I should say that probably we have more Andy Murray fans following the Tennis Podcast simply because we're British and it's and he's a British player, I would imagine. But I also do feel, Catherine, that if that poll had been taken 6 months ago, it would not be reading that. I think you're quite right. Things have changed a little bit. I think most people here think that Murray will win in three or four, or Djokovic will win in three or four. There's a number that think Murray might do it in five and outlast Djokovic. And, of course, that is the result that we had a year ago at the French Open in the semi-finals. Catherine, you said at the outset of the tournament that Novak Djokovic would win it. What are you saying
now? I feel
now?
Exactly the same as I did at the beginning of the tournament. I have to predict Djokovic to win it. He is the favourite. He's the best tennis player in the world. But there is just a part of me in my gut that's saying Andy Murray's going to win this and I can't get rid of it. But look, my prediction, if we're putting something down on paper, is Novak Djokovic. But I do want to give an honourable mention to my slight...
No, hold on. I don't want any of this. Oh, well, I told you my gut feeling happens.
I was
on paper and I said Novak Djokovic.
Djokovic to win anything at the moment. How I don't see how you can really do that. But I mean,
Yeah, but what do you actually think? I mean, I don't, you know, don't give me all this, well, you can't predict.
I actually think it's about 50-50, honestly. I really do.
Who's going to win?
I think it's pretty... Well, I'm saying Djokovic, as I say. If I'm putting something down on the record, I'm saying Djokovic. But I think, honestly, it's about 50-50. I really do think that.
How many sets?
Almost impossible to say, actually. I think if Djokovic is... I think if Murray's going to win it, it'll be probably in four. I think if Djokovic is going to win it, it could be anything. But, I mean, come on. I'll say Djokovic in five, then. If my neck insists, or if you insist on my neck being on the line, Djokovic in five.
I do. Well, I think Djokovic... in four or five, and I will say four because I think that that's the most typical scoreline between the two. I still feel the same. I mean, the fact of the way Murray's playing is as well as I've ever seen him play. The last match that I've just seen him play against Wawrinka, I thought he was majestic and he was hitting the ball so hard. I mean, he was going toe to toe with Stan Wawrinka and he was winning some of those rallies on brute force, which I was shocked by.
The other thing is that particularly what sprung out to me in that match was how beautifully that backhand down the line is firing, and that's really important against Novak Djokovic. The other thing that I think possibly, which I can slightly attribute my contrary gut feeling to, is after that first round marathon match against what he was referred to on Twitter as the ancient Radek Stepanek, which is a bit harsh. He was 2 points away from losing in the first round to Radek Stepanek, and Andy Murray came into press, and I ran that press conference, and there was a moment when, you know, he was asked a pretty general question about, you know, how do you feel about that match? And he said, that could turn out to be one of the biggest wins of my life. And I got a bit of a shiver down my spine, you know. It just felt like one of those... This could be completely ridiculous. You know how I'm a rubbish predictor. I'm over-sentimental. But I did just get a bit of a feeling. And I just had that moment of thinking, I'm going to remember him saying that. And now I'm remembering him saying that. And let's just, you know, in posterity, edit this portion of the podcast out when he inevitably loses to Djokovic on all Sunday. Right. And we'll repost it free of all this rubbish. But yeah,
right.
There it
okay,
is.
Okay, fine. Well, I still feel that Djokovic is ready, and the time will come when he will come out and play his statement tennis that he so often plays in these big matches against the best players. And he has that ability, doesn't he, to... The same way as Murray had the ability to neutralise Wawrinka today with all those different types of paces and then the power, Djokovic has invariably had that same ability to neutralise Andy Murray with depth, with his movement, with just the sheer precision and persistence and consistency that he has. And I think that that will ultimately tell. But I think I'd be surprised if it wasn't at least four sets. And, well, let's hope we have a great final. It's going to be fascinating.
Hey. Back to that old equality point. We didn't do predictions for the women's final, David.
Didn't we?
No.
Oh, well, I said Serena Williams to win the tournament against Garbiñe Muguruza final at the outset of the tournament, Catherine Mishka. So, you know.
Okay.
I predicted both finals correctly.
That wasn't me giving you an opportunity to be smug, though.
Well,
you've
got it.
Misread it
so
as
just
such.
Deal with it, because that's the fact.
Well, how many sets is it going to be?
I think it will be three. Yeah, I think it will be three. I feel as though the four players that we have are all playing too well and are all sufficiently experienced to play well in this final. And I think if they all play well, I would expect Muguruza to push Williams and win a set.
Oh yeah, I think I'd be surprised if she didn't win a set, actually. I really think it'll be competitive. I'm going for Serena in three. But it could easily not be that. But I'm going for Serena in three.
There you go, tipsters. I'm going for Serena in three, but it could easily not be that. So anyway, that's Catherine Whittaker's little guarantee of what's going to happen. So get your money on all that.
Uncertainty and self-deprecation is preferable to smugness any day, David.
Yeah, well, I'm all for smugness. Just very quickly, Catherine, when you were talking about that great press conference that Murray did when he was talking about the Stepanek victory potentially being one of the best of his career. Obviously, he then went and had another five-setter in the next round. And at that point, Catherine, I posed on Twitter at Tennis Podcast for people to come up with their tennis Houdini acts from tennis years gone by. And there were some absolute corkers of players that were in real strife and ended up still winning a Grand Slam title. Some corkers here. Listen to this. We've got Boiled Egg. Whoever came up with that Twitter handle needs to have a think, who said, surely the best one is Stefan Edberg. From a breakdown in the fifth set in the last 16 of the US Open in 1992 against Richard Krajicek. He was a breakdown, fifth set, won it. But oh no, that wasn't the end of it. He then went five sets against Lendl in the quarters. Then he went five sets against Chang in the longest match in US Open history. And then he faced Pete Sampras in the final and beat him in four sets. How about that for a tennis Houdini act from Stefan Edberg? We've got Ewan McQueen in Scotland who says, what about Goran Ivanišević in 2001? He had a five-setter in the final and in the semi, plus, and don't forget that was 3 days against Tim Hemman, plus 4 setters against Safin and Roddick, and he was a wild card, hashtag Tennis Houdini. We've got Declan McDonald from Northern Ireland. What about Agassi Medvedev? 1999 French Open, 2 sets down, Agassi never won the title. He was going for the career slam, and he made it happen. Jonathan Woodrow says Federer, 2 sets down, 3-4, 30-40 against Tommy Haas, who incidentally Ooh. Has just been announced as the new Indian Wells tournament director tonight. Tommy Haas was 2 sets up, 4-3 up, 40-30 on Federer's serve. Federer saved it and went on to win that title with an incredible inside-out forehand onto the line. Mary Smythe says, in Ireland, what about Novak beating Federer at the US Open in 2011, facing 2 match points, hits an epic cross-court forehand return, goes on to win the title, Tennis Houdini. And finally, Stephen Fraser on a Murray note. Vadasco, Wimbledon, 2013, 2 sets down, went on to win the title.
Hang on, you haven't mentioned mine. Mine was really good, I thought. I thought it deserved a mention.
Sorry, was this the one where I overruled your match point and you went on to beat me twice? Is that the one?
No, because you didn't actually get out of that. I don't think that's anything Houdini would have been remotely
proud of.
Oh, OK,
so what's yours then?
Mine was Roddick Nalbandian, US Open 2003, semi-final. Roddick saved a match point in the third set tiebreak and came back to win. Happy memories.
Happy memories indeed, yes. Of course, Roddick's only Grand Slam title. Amazing to think, isn't it? When you see a player win a Grand Slam title the way Roddick did, and he went to world number one to think he was 21 years of age, and that he didn't win another one. And it shows how great Federer was, particularly in the 5 years that followed. And all the rest is history, as they say. Well, Catherine, what we do know for sure is we've got an emotional and hopefully fantastic weekend of tennis to look forward to. It deserves it, Paris, doesn't it, after the couple of weeks it's just had?
We deserve it. I trudged into
just
Roland
us,
Garros
just us on
day.
The tennis podcast, and you listeners, just us.
Through the half a mile walk being patted down by security at sort of 10 metre intervals in a not particularly effective way. stepping in numerous puddles, being made to undo your jacket. I mean, I just arrived every day feeling rather bedraggled.
Did you ever find the quiche?
No.
You've
From
given
that
up
perspective,
quiches,
also
you?
A total disaster. And do you know what? On the Eurostar on the way home, there was a family that had a quiche picnic. I mean, they must
did
have
you
had,
get cash?
They must have had 10 quiches on the go.
And
there were
how
only
many
four
did you
them.
Eat of those 10?
I felt like you'd organised it or something. It was,
well, did they invite
it was,
you?
It
or?
Was salt in a very still raw wound.
So they didn't even take pity and just say, Catherine, do you fancy a quiche?
No, I mean, I didn't want to be that freak on the Eurostar that's inviting themselves to other people's quiche parties.
Yeah, but all you needed to say was, hello, I'm Catherine Whittaker, Tennis Podcast. You know that quiche I was talking about on the show the other day. Can I,
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, they were probably listening to the Tennis Podcast while they were eating the quiche, frankly.
Probably. That's why they're having a Tennis Podcast quiche party, is what it was. And if that is you listening to us right now, thank you for stopping Catherine having the quiche, because we know it's not the best thing for you, isn't it, actually? But anyway...
Hey, the salmon and broccoli one wasn't bad.
Oh, okay.
That was my fave.
I think it's time to stop, Catherine. We started talking about quiche again, and it's been very nice talking to you. We are the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. We have a couple of fantastic finals to look forward to. We've got the doubles finals as well. Follow the lot, and we will be back to talk to you about it all after the event. We've got the Aegon Championships at the Queen's Club coming up in just over a week's time, and we hope we're not going to get any rain there. We don't usually. I usually organise that we don't. You know, it's one of the plus points of being 6'7". You can have a quick chat up there in the clouds, and you don't get any rain. But anyway, we are the Tennis Podcast. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.